The Green Team speaks to Michael Sheeran. Michael is senior advisor within the Bank of England, and he also co-chaired the G20 Sustainable Finance Study Group with China in 2016. He's actively involved in domestic and international green finance activities, including bilateral negotiations related to the UK's economic and finance dialogues with China, Brazil, and India. Michael is also heavily involved in the bank's fintech and digital finance work. Prior to joining the bank, Michael spent over 25 years in the debt capital markets, where he specialized in structuring, distribution, and trading debt for major global financial institutions in New York and London. All views expressed here are strictly his own and do not necessarily represent that of any institutions where he has a role. We are pleased to have Michael join us today.
My first question, as a senior advisor at the Bank of England and through your work with the G20 Green Finance Working Group and, I guess, Sustainable Finance Working Group, you've really been at the forefront of driving a lot of the green finance growth and adoption in the UK and globally. Could you tell us a little bit more about that process and that, you know, taking green finance from a very niche topic to right now probably the buzz in the financial industry? So wondering if you could give briefly some of your expectations going forward as you've seen for this year and maybe for this decade, because it's very important.
Great. No. Thank you. That's an important question, as you pointed out, and I think it's absolutely one that's on everybody's mind these days. What's particularly interesting is it's been a great path of travel over the last 4 or 5 years, where green or broadly sustainable finance has really picked up. Just historically, as some of the people involved in the markets may know, they've heard about the G20 and they've heard about some of the work that we've done at the Bank of England, but they've always wondered what started this and why we started even thinking about sustainable finance. And the key element behind that is, first of all, from a international organization like the G20, they look for financial stability, look for where is risk building up in potentially in the financial markets. So the Bank of England about 5 years ago, as part of the Climate Change Act of 2008, did a report that I was very much involved in looking at how well the insurance industry was adapting to climate change. And we didn't think that anyone would be paying much attention to this, but it turned out they were. Quite a few people were, including the Chinese, who were just about to host the G20. And they wanted to put in their presidency only one new piece of work around green finance, sustainable finance. And they wanted to put it in the finance track, which is the track of the central banks and the finance ministries. And they viewed this as absolutely essential for two reasons. One is there's a lot of negative externalities tied to the forces behind what's driving green finance. And negative externalities, free riding ones, I might add, are just a fancy word or a fancy phrase for just bad things that are tied to either production or services in the real economy that aren't being accounted for in the price. So a good example is years and years ago, there was lead in paint. Well, the lead in the paint, the lead was a negative externality for many years that wasn't included in the price. So that means many people got sick, but the manufacturers didn't have to pay for it. Same thing was true with asbestos. And now the world has become incredibly aware that carbon is existential to the species, and you need carbon because it's part of the process of generating energy for making almost anything in the real economy. And of course, as you know, the oil that keeps the real economy going is financing. The banking industry basically finances the real economy, the cars we drive, the infrastructure that we build, the consumer goods that we buy. Yeah. So basically, green finance or sustainable finance really was born around climate change, i.e. carbon being produced in so many products and services that we do, the threat to our species on that. But as we started working into how do you think about the risks associated with it, and to be fair, the opportunities around transitioning to a more sustainable economy, a groundswell came, and it came from both the bottom, from individual people who started recognizing that pollution and the threats around climate change were things that policymakers in the real economy had to respond to, but also was getting response from the top. People like Governor Carney, who at the time was the head of the FSB and the Bank of England, who recognized the risks inside of it. So over a very short period of time, the focus came to how do we use finance as a tool to motivate and to actually finance a transition to a more sustainable economy. And so, as I said, in the early days around carbon and green finance really came through our work in the G20. And I would say, if you've been to the World Economic Forum over the last 2 years, this has caught on, as you said, from a niche discussion amongst smaller players and asset managers to literally the most important topic that you hear from CEOs of the biggest companies in the world.
Absolutely. It's really kind of top of mind and top of agenda for a lot of some more of the commercial players. And so it's getting a lot of, I guess you'd say, airtime or it's getting a lot of the spotlight now. So
It has an effect, and pardon me for interrupting, but what's particularly interesting around it is the tools that the financial community needs to make these decisions are actually pretty similar to the ones they currently use. So if you're a banker or an investor, and you've looked at a stock or a bond, looked at either financing a company or financing an asset, you look at what the costs are of that particular company, that is things for production costs, marketing, things of that sort, what they are. And then you just determine whether or not you think their projections on sales will make it a sustainable company. But what hasn't been included in those expenses is all those, as I said, free riding negative externalities that properly price it. And what's particularly interesting in the discussions literally over the last year or two is banks and asset managers and asset owners looking at those free riding negative externalities. And we've talked about carbon as being the most important one, but actually looking at water usage, looking at plastics, and there's a whole host of other elements, free riders that are in part of the real economy process that aren't getting priced into these goods and services. And increasingly, as the finance community starts understanding that, they basically will take a look and say, well, my goodness, we've got to price in to the acquisition of this company, them mitigating their carbon footprint. And that really takes the form of something straightforward. How much CapEx, how much cash a year out of your free cash flow or your EBITDA, how much cash into R&D needs to go into each company to make them a carbon neutral or a carbon free company. And that's the interesting element around the green and sustainable finance. The tools that the financial community has already works. It's just the new variables around these that are really making asset pricing and company pricing. What's a company that's really on the go and it's moving upwards in value, and which ones aren't actually doing this and the values are being, there's degradation related to this. So again, it's new ideas, it's new variables, but the great part of the financing element is using the tools that have been traditionally used to evaluate both assets and companies when you're trying to determine how to finance them. And being optimistic is correct, because what you get out of this, and look at any type of transition does cause a certain amount of disruption. However, the financing and the opportunities there, there's over $120 trillion of money that's in the hands of institutional investors. And so as we talked about getting things priced right, so there might be some gratuitous or consumption items when you add in the cost of carbon and you add in the cost of water, they may not be profitable goods. However, the need to transition energy, i.e. start building much more renewable energy, is absolutely astounding. So the cash may move out of some areas where once you start applying the cost of these negative externalities, they go into areas where they're better set. And a good example is the International Energy Agency put out a report in October of 2019, last year. And they basically had done an analysis on the technological developments on offshore wind. And their view was that by 2040, you could generate enough power for the entire world on offshore wind. Now, obviously, you'll need solar and other types of renewable energy, because obviously not every country has access to the sea. But it's a very powerful idea. It's an inspiring idea. And so the financing, the money will flow to the areas that will allow the global economy to transition. And once you get your energy transitioned, that allows for other parts of the real economy, mobility, real estate, agriculture, to follow in and follow suit.
Absolutely. And so I'm going to skip ahead to another question that I had, because you mentioned the disruption and transformation. You're also a very active thought leader in the fintech and digital technology space. And so with these technologies becoming, becoming more and more advanced, how do you see it really disrupting or transforming green finance in any way?
Again, that's a great question, because obviously addressing climate change is certainly the mega trend of the century, but an equal one, and the one that will be a great enabler, is going to be technology. I'll give you a couple of good examples. I gave you four of the big industrial sectors that are going to be important to transition. Mobility, that's cars, planes, ships, things of that sort. You're already seeing electric vehicles begin to really get traction globally. You're able to see that in the shipping industry, they're coming up with ships that are powered by hydrogen. I believe one of the European carriers is going to have an electric jet doing a London to Amsterdam flights by 2023. So the areas, the interesting thing about using technology, I use the offshore wind as an example. Up in the UK, there's a city called Hull, which used to be an industrial port city, and it really fell upon hard times, but now it's resurrecting because they make the most technologically advanced wind turbine blades. And wind turbine blades are very much like aircraft wings, very technical and very important. So technology is going to play a huge role across our sectors. Another great example is agriculture. Two-thirds, actually almost 75% of all soybeans grown globally are used to feed livestock. However, now you're seeing plant-based protein companies that are not only doing incredibly well in the markets, but what they're doing is they're giving the consumer an experience equal to or better than their original ones. I mean, obviously Impossible Burgers, Beyond Meat, all of these are doing incredibly well. And they're using, and as you start thinking about agriculture, ways that are much less carbon intensive. Livestock, not only do you have to, grow the crops to feed them, huge amounts of water go into it, the crops are transported, the livestock. So trying to become less dependent on meat will be a bit, through technology, will be big. And probably one of the best examples of that is vertical farms. I was looking at one of them that is one of the market leaders, and they can do 26 crops a year, 26 turns. They use 90% less water, and they're nutritionally better than those that are grown outside. Now, you certainly can't do every type of, it's amazing. You can't do every crop, obviously, in a vertical farm. But if you want blueberries in February, instead of flying them in from Brazil or Israel, basically imagine we have a circular road around London. It's called the M25. Imagine if you had vertical farms around the M25 that had things like lettuce and certain types of fruits and berries, in which you could run 26 crops a year on them. We have this great electric van company in North London. You could have those, pick them up, bring them into London. You start thinking about what a new economy could actually look like. And so much of that is driven by technology. So the vertical farms are technology, the vans using either fuel cells or electric batteries are technology. You'll see sensors in buildings that can actually monitor the water, the electricity. You can have a smart, you can really have truly smart buildings. So you don't, it's hard to put this much emphasis. It's hard to put not enough emphasis on the technology and how important it will be. It will drive the sustainability movement, and it will make our ability to make these transitions infinitely easier and infinitely faster, and hopefully in time that we won't bear the harder brunt of climate change in the next 30, 40, 50 years.
Right, and specifically in the for financial industries, are there ways that technology will be influential or impactful?
Absolutely, and that was going to be my next point, because you can't change the old real economy without changing the financial community. Right. And I think this is a great opportunity. So if you think about, all right, the production of the future is going to be technology driven, and let's use an example of, again, electric car. So a company makes that, and if they start digitizing the information around it, we're not talking just the normal things about where the spare tire is, but also about the impact information, the carbon information, all the information around the sustainability piece of it. That information, you could use that as an on-ramp into a digitally financed platform. So that information would go into a blockchain. That information would be in machine language, natural language. So all of a sudden, you're able to get all the information very quickly. So financing, banking, so that information comes into a financial institution. It's in blockchain, it's in machine language. It can understand the credit information around that. Things like your anti-money laundering, all your KYC information would be automated. Your portfolios would be completely digitized. The actual full amount of the institution would be in the cloud. And then ultimately you could issue green asset-based digital securities that could be purchased by institutional investors who are desperately looking for green bonds. So the whole idea of taking technology that gives you financing faster, cheaper, and more importantly, more transparently. For so many years, literally since I've been in the markets and well before then, financing was a game of asymmetric information. If you remember the book and the movie, both Liar's Poker and The Big Short. And in The Big Short, you had a fund looking at a stack a yard high of mortgage documents, and they had to read through each one to try and figure out how many of them were bad subprime mortgages. But if all those documents were in machine language and digitized, an institutional investor, a big pension fund, could look instantaneously into every one of those documents and understand what they are. So the transparency is going to be, the technology will allow for very quick reading on preferences. But because we have to transition to a sustainable economy, the only way you're going to get good pricing in the financial markets is to demonstrate quickly and authentic in an authentic way that your either your business or your assets are green. So transparency, which was the opposite of what the financial community has traditionally used, ultimately people had to do due diligence, and they gave them the bare amount of information, which you have to do. But here, granular information is available instantaneously, and it's going to be transparent, and they'll be able to demonstrate that either companies or the assets are green and sustainable. And I think this type of technology employed in the financial system will be absolutely allow us to supercharge the financing of the transition.
Yes, the efficiencies that you mentioned that come with the technology in the financial sector will be, I think, very, as you said, key and transformational going forward. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. It will provide, and this is what we were talking, the key to the G20. They wanted us to bring in the private sector, and we brought in not just the banks, we brought in the rating agencies, we brought in the hedge funds, we literally brought in the entire ecosystem, the financial community. This is particularly true during the 2018 G20 that was hosted by Argentina. And we brought in the entire private sector and said, all right, how could we take things like offshore wind and solar, and basically if we digitize all the information, and then we're able to put these financial digitized products into the market, it could drive the energy. So again, it's powerful, and it's really part of the nucleus of how we're going to make the transition.
I will then again segue, because you mentioned the private sector and all the other stakeholders. And so one thing I think the Bank of England and some of the other global central banks are doing is spearheading this effort called the Network of Greening the Financial System, that is really looking to, kind of strengthen the global response to meeting the Paris goals and enhancing the role of the financial system to manage risks and mobilize capital for green and low carbon investment. Do efforts like this matter, and how do you see the priorities for this year for the NGFS, or if you'd like to talk about any of the challenges that a group like that might encounter?
Yeah, no, I think the NGFS is an incredible example of key stakeholders, i.e. regulators and central banks, recognizing and exploring where risk sits within the financial system. And that's, almost everybody in this ecosystem is in the risk business. Obviously, investors are looking for risk-adjusted reward, but for central banks and the NGFS, their goal is to try and identify risks, and then once identifying them, be able to empirically demonstrate it and then look for ways of mitigating it. And the Bank of England, the Dutch Central Bank, the Swedes, and the French were for the first banks to start putting this together. And this did come out of a lot of the work in the G20. And we thought through cooperation and sharing of information and where we thought risk would be, we could really move quicker and faster. We had no idea how important and how popular it is. The last time I checked, I think there are now 53 central banks / regulators from 53 countries around the world. And this started in, I think it was 2017. If you would have thought that 53 central banks and regulators would be joining a group, and to your question about what are they looking for? So obviously we want to transition, we want to grow green things, but again, central banks are looking for risk. So being able to get data and quantify what's also brown, and be able to figure out how a sector of the economy goes from brown to less brown to hopefully eventually green. And why this impacts the financial system so much is obviously banks provide loans to the real economy. So if you're bank number A and your portfolio is skewed to the high carbon activities, and you're a major bank within a financial jurisdiction, you're putting real risk. Consequently, if you're in a high carbon industry and you're getting financing globally, and the bonds for those are sitting in insurance companies and pension funds, those are the types of things that regulators and central banks are looking for. What type of risk is bubbling up that could change valuations very quickly? And you heard me say earlier on about change in values. So the UK implemented a law saying that by 2040, we will no longer produce any hybrid or internal combustion engine cars, nor will we allow anyone to export into our jurisdiction. It looks like that will now be brought forward to 2035. So that means you want to look at where does the debt of the assets of the internal combustion cars, where does that sit? You know, when you looked at the subprime mortgage, you try to think, where are those sitting in the system? And what the NGFS is looking at is where is the risk where climate can manifest itself either in bank balance sheets, in the stocks and bonds held by insurance companies and pension funds, How do you quantify that? How do you start putting, how do you start managing this? The Bank of England put out a note on how to supervise the banks and insurance companies for climate risk. So the 52 banks, central banks, are now talking about this and sharing information across borders. And we've got everyone from the Bank of Mexico to China to the state of California. Insurance regulator is a member, and there's been talk of the U.S. Fed joining as well now. So it's a global organization looking to identify risk, quantify that risk, try to understand how you can mitigate it, and to share that information and across countries and across boundaries to be able to understand how we can move globally to mitigate the climate risk. So again, in less than 3 years, this organization has really stepped forward, and I would say it's in the forefront of understanding and looking to mitigate climate risk within the financial system.
Last question I'll give you, it's probably a softball for you, and given all the examples that we have from the UK, I think it'll be pretty easy to say. I think there's the COP26 that the UK is hosting, and kind of what are your expectations, and what do you think that the role for green finance could have it as a meeting sort of like this, and if you know, are there any kind of more realistic outcomes that we could be looking at?
Yeah, I'll give you one thing that I think is also snuck up on people, just like the NGFS. No one really saw that coming, mm-hmm. And it's the net zero trend. So again, I'm sorry for talking my book, but the UK has already passed a law saying the entire economy has to be net carbon zero by 2050. Now the EU is actively going towards that as well. You've got cities that have done it, such as Copenhagen. I know Hong Kong is looking at it. And I think having that as a profound discussion at COP26 is going to be really important. If you think about it, even if not every jurisdiction in the world adopts this, even if it's just the EU, we are still a global economy. We still have supply chains everywhere. And ultimately, if you're a global company and you've gone net zero in the EU and in the UK, you're going to need to think about how you do your supply chain, because you, again, won't be able to import into these jurisdictions without having a net carbon zero. And if you look at the work that's being done by the NGFS, so you've got a regulatory focus moving in one direction, which could ultimately, and then you've got from the legislative side, the net zero laws. These are not voluntary. These are real hard laws, and they're coming into effect. So I think that really broadens and opens up the discussion and brings on a sense of pace and urgency around the COP to say, all right, We've committed to now doing this. We're not just talking about it. I mean, certainly the Paris Accords were groundbreaking, but now people are putting it in their local legislature, their local laws, and they're required to do it. So I think that's going to be a fascinating way to really expedite the conversation around COP26, things around you're going to want to expedite the disclosure movement. TCFD, it's been moving and it's been accelerating for 5 years. Well, I think this is going to put it right out in the forefront. How you start thinking about transforming the through technology, those sectors of the economy are going to be huge. And every bit of it needs to be financed, and it needs to be financed faster, cheaper, and more transparently. So I think this COP has the opportunity to bring these things together that, again, no one had on their future facing horizons even 2-3 years ago.
Lots of work ahead, huh?
Yeah, tremendous amount of work, but there's good payoffs. And I think if you're asking, you know, what are the things that people should be thinking about, and they're the one set of stakeholders that I don't think have been engaged enough. We've got the politicians and the regulators, we have the financial community, and we have the real economy. But one area that's been left out of the broader discussion, and people like Greta Thunberg have been fantastic at starting to raise the awareness again at the you know, amongst young people, But, you know, people have tough lives. They've got their jobs they come home with. They've got to deal with things. And what I think it's also important to communicate to them that their children are going to have happier, healthier lives because they'll have cleaner air, better water. Their jobs are going to be future facing and more stable. So in a world where there's a lot of anxiety, actually starting to transition the economy is something that should be, people should be looking forward to and really pushing and feeling good about. As said, on the agriculture side, you know, eating, you know, less meat, but having a great experience through an Impossible Burger or a Beyond Meat Burger or some other kind of thing, it's allowing individuals to actually participate in the transition, but not really sacrifice anything and feel good about it. And also know that the long-term outcomes are going to be nothing but good for them.
Well, Michael, this has all been very interesting. I'd like to say thank you again for being so generous with your time and for sharing your thoughts and experiences with us today. Thank you.